Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. Hi, Shereen.
Hi, Anna. Wow. This episode made me wiser.
Wow. This is a great episode. I cannot stress that enough. This is a great episode.
Yeah. I heard some things that are rearranging stuff in my brain as we speak. My imposter syndrome, let's just say, really needed to hear certain things. We are joined by the incredible Dr. Tunisha Singleton. She is so wise. She's a media psychologist. She is a sports entertainment professional that has this deep dive into what fandom is and everything. I think she knows about every single subject, to be honest.
Dr. Tunisha is also the host of I Have Questions podcast and another one that I was on entitled Never Meet Your Heroes with former guest Jabari Ali Davis. So look, Dr. Tunisha is the one you need to be listening to. So stay tuned for this really great episode because we think you're going to love it.
Who are we? Where do we come from? Who do we become? What is it to be? What to be is it? Where are we? Who are my parents? Where are my pets? Why were we born? We are Ethnically Ambiguous.
Hi.
Hi, Anna. Hi.
How are you?
I'm all right. Honestly, this week has been really nice in LA. Not today, but like Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday were overcast and gloomy and perfect for like going outside on a walk, not hot. And I feel like my depression, I have like reverse seasonal depression where I get happier when it's gloomier. So I had a great couple of days. I went on walks and did yoga when I could, trying to hashtag self-care.
Hashtag self-care. I love that. I've never heard of such a thing. You're allowed to take care of yourself?
Yeah, I don't get it. You can try.
No, you can't, but you can try. I feel that. I have nothing new to add. I'm always doing the same thing, which is sitting in this exact spot, never moving.
Well, okay. Do you prefer a sunny day or a gloomy day? I'm just curious.
I prefer both.
That's fair. I think most people would prefer sunny. I'm not trying to be like, oh my God, look at me, how special, but maybe I'll do a poll or something.
Please do a poll. Yeah, nothing to add, really. I'm just doing the same thing, sitting here and podcasting until I guess I pass away. I guess I'll podcast on my deathbed, it's looking like these days.
We'll put a microphone in your coffin.
Yes, thank you. And as the flood comes and washes me away.
Okay, that's enough of that. Should we just get into this?
Yes, we have a great guest today. Now, I met this guest when I did their podcast called Never Meet Your Heroes, who they host with former guest Jabari Ali Davis. They had me on, which I was quite honored to be on the show because I guess they hadn't had guests on yet. So I was like, wow, okay, wow, okay, you know, and you'll feel yourself a little. But yes, they're a podcast host. They're a doctor, okay? Maybe you've heard of it. They also have another show called I Have Questions. Look, I'm just going to bring them in because I think they're a very interesting person, which when I met them originally, I was like, got to talk further to this human being because they know what's up when it comes to sports, when it comes to culture, when it comes to being a doctor, when it comes to media, baby, when it comes to just, I guess, being a great person. We are joined by Dr. Tunisha Singleton. Hi.
Thank you. That was like the best damn intro ever. Awesome.
Thanks. I like to go long with my intros.
Media baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get it.
I have a few smarts. At least you know, some people pay me for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you worked hard for it. You might as well.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I don't make anybody like call me doctor, like, except like if if I'm doing a talk, if we're strangers, yeah, you can call me doctor, right? If it's like that, the appropriate setting, right? Students, sure. Work, speaking engagements, absolutely. Does my mom have to call me doc? No, she helped pay for it. brother, family, friends, nah. But it's like, yeah, I was quoted in Vanity Fair, the September issue, talking about fandom and identity and community behavior and stuff. And then it was cute because the interview was like back in March, but then I forgot about it. And then it came out in the September issue. And I didn't know until somebody DM'd me on Twitter. And they were like, hey, cool quote in Vanity Fair. I was like, what the fuck? Oh, yeah. Oh, cool. And then I look, I buy like four. And then I look at it. It's like, oh, Tanisha Singleton, Kyle, I'm a media psychologist. And I was like, oh, give me my PhD. Just put some respect on my name, please.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
say, at least put the three letters at the end or put the doc up front, like some team.
Especially if you're being quoted in
you
like anything.
Yeah. That's what I was like, come on now.
I do like saying Dr. Tanisha, though. I like that.
I thank you. Yeah, I get Dr. T a lot. And I'm like, whichever. The good doctor, whatever. I'll take
That's pretty sick that you got quoted in Vanity Fair, though. What was that like? Like, how did that come about?
It was random. I don't know. I was actually driving from, I'm originally from Riverside, California, and I'd moved to Las Vegas about a year and a half ago, and I was driving back. It's like 3 hours. And I would check an email, you know, as I'm driving. Probably shouldn't, but, you know, I looked at it and somebody was like, I don't know if I was listed as an expert or thought leader in like some Rolodex of smart. I don't know, but somebody reached out and I don't know how they found me. I'm like, hey, I understand that you study fandom. You're a media psychologist. That sounds awesome and interesting and weird. What is that? Can I talk to you? And I was like, okay. So spoke with them on the drive up. And it was an article about fan identity and kind of some of the like toxic behavior and just kind of making sense of fandom today, especially like in, you know, the thick of COVID and all of this stuff. And I was talking, I spoke a little bit about that and it was neat getting quoted. It's one of those things I was like, oh yeah, cool. I like that.
Yeah. It's nice to be recognized. And honestly, when I was looking at like your bio and your experience and everything, the idea of fandom has always fascinated and truly horrified me in a way. Yeah. Like, I don't understand it.
Yeah.
I don't understand the celebrity thing or any, like, I don't understand where someone gets that like intense change, like thing. The title media psychologist, I think, is just like, that's what we need right now. We need people to tell us what we're doing to ourselves after all this time.
For real. I entered the program in 2013. I graduated January of 17. So it took about 3.5, 4 years to finish. And yeah, it just felt like a natural evolution. Like, I did not like psych. I never liked psych. I got a C in psych when I did it in undergrad. I was not about it at all. But then I just noticed as I was working, the industry was changing. I watched sports change. My own fandom was changing. I noticed things around me. The landscape was like, like, I'm just all about like peeping shit, respond, and, you know, and just draw like some insight out of that. And so, and just, while looking at all that, I was like, yo, there's something, something's going on. And maybe that's just a part of becoming an adult, growing, just recognizing that some things are now important now that wasn't prior to you. And I wanted to be ahead of it. I wanted to be at the curve of that and at least know how to critically think and know how to peep shit intellectually and be able to like translate that into something else. So I think I'm a professional translator or like a communicator at that point, because it is all about just understanding those patterns between like media consumption and human behavior. What you put in, how does that influence what you do, what you believe? How do we make meaning? And what are the relationships we have with this stuff? When is it important? When is it? But I always think technology is a tool, right? It's a utility to something. It's not the thing. Like, I don't care about the thing. I want to know what it enhances and why do I need that enhancement? That's what understanding media psychology is really all about, and it being rooted obviously in our human fundamentals and the human experience. And now we multiply that by the infinity levels of digital and technology and social and virtual and all of these different things. Like, this is rooted in every single industry. There's nothing that doesn't touch technology and media at some point, because we're all in the people business. I don't care if we sell toilet paper or a campaign slogan, or if we're trying to solicit votes or a new t-shirt or a new slogan or something. Like, it's all about, we're all in the people business. So it behooves us to kind of understand how people function.
You're right.
Yeah.
I never think about anything, but you're right.
You're completely right. I mean, it's just, it's really scary what our phones and just that, everything. You're so right. It's all connected and related, and just the internet and social media. I feel like our brains are just like reverting to like lizard brains, like, or like we're just like programmed, and like you don't even realize you're like pulling out your phone like as a reflex, like a what's
reflex.
That word? like a muscle memory kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Like, what else am I going to do? Okay, scrolling, whatever. It freaks me out.
Yeah, and then it can be scary when we catch our own reflection in how we use it, right? When you're like, oh my God, like I need white noise to go to bed now. Let me put on the app, right? It's like, mm-hmm. we didn't know how to sleep before. Pretty sure we did, but this is about how to use it positively. And I think a part of it is we need to activate like our own level of awareness so that we can see, all right, I care way too much about how many likes I just got. I'm going to not use this as much, right? Or, oh my God, I've just met so many cool people on Twitter because we weren't out loud outside anymore. I love this space that I get mm-hmm. to meet like-minded, dope people, and I wouldn't distinguish my level of connection or friends with them just because I met them on an app as opposed to, you know, in a park or in a locker room. I mean, we get job interviews by just cold calling and emailing online, and it's like, and we end up, you know, so it's like, how big is the difference between like when we solicit and pimp ourselves for jobs online and meeting strangers that way as opposed to like, yo, what's up? Like for dating or to go to tailgate together or anything like that. I think it's just as long as we can remain a bit conscious about digital literacy, media literacy, the good and bad, and how we can use it more innovatively, fill in the gaps. Like, I think innovation is just, you recognize a need, you recognize a problem, and you solve it. That's what innovation is to me. It's that fucking simple. And it's like, it doesn't require white lab coats and test tubes and beakers with blue liquid and smoke and shit coming out of it. Like, it's like, nah, just innovation is you see a problem, you try and fix it. You try and make a solution. Mm-hmm. And given it all of the new opportunity and advancements in tech, yeah, let's take advantage of it and fix some shit that's been broken before. How can we restore some connections? How can we restore something that was once lost? And those, I think, are cool advantages of technology. But of course, there's bullying and all the other things, you know, but that also, I still see none of that, I think, is necessarily new, right? Like locker rooms, playgrounds, seen bullying in the 90s and the 80s. Like we're just giving everyone a new platform. That's good and bad. And mm-hmm. until humans fix their problem, we can't just blame the tech. Because bullying and cyber shit has been happening forever. We just have new spaces now to do it. It's a human problem. It's not the phone's fault.
Humans have a lot of problems.
We got a lot of shit going on. And it's our fault. We have to check ourselves. It's easy to say, oh my God, it's Twitter's fault. And it's like, is it? Or is it the motherfucker with the thumb thugs behind it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thumb thugs. So I it's like
how
that.
To, you know, so it's like, how do
you
we.
You should trademark that ASAP.
Yeah. Right? Like these thug thumbs out here are just like sitting on the toilet or in their mom's basement. They're just like, oh, well, double chin or whatever. You know, it's their problem. They're the problem, right? Because we are never allowed anything nice. And so, because whenever we get something nice, there's always going to be somebody to taint it and pervert it mm-hmm. and twist it into something else. We've been having that issue forever.
Also, like, it changes your perspective on everything. Like, I remember wanting to podcast because I was like, oh, it's so great. You can get all this information out. And, you know, like, one of the shows I work on, Daily Zeitgeist, I was like, God, it's so wonderful because I can, like, you know, we're doing something so crazy. It's a daily show. Oh, my God. Wow. And then, like, within the first year, I was like, I don't want to be on it. People are mean. I don't want to be on it.
Hey, it takes a thick-ass skin, you know? Yeah.
And but inversely, like, through our show, it's a good example. Like, we've been able to connect with people, like, literally globally.
Mm-hmm.
And we get messages saying that they feel less alone or they feel seen. And that's absolutely incredible to me.
That's huge.
Like, there are definitely upsides. And mm-hmm. the whole friend thing you mentioned, my little sister, her best friends, she met on an online game. And they're, mm-hmm. like, it's like second to sisterhood to her, you know? So
exactly. Like, we shouldn't have to qualify things like, oh, this is my Twitter friend. It's like, nah, if I fuck with you, I fuck with you. Like, you're my friend or not, you know? And it's like, oh, we've never met in IRL, like in real life and stuff. But that, to me, you know, it'll happen when it happens. I mean, I have, you know, my best friend that, you know, we met in kindergarten. She lives in Chicago now. I'm in Vegas now. We haven't seen each other in a couple of years. But, like, how we rank our relationships, like, that's all just, it's never copy and paste. That's just individually, right? Like, how we measure our level of connections and affiliations with communities and stuff. And that's where a lot of my research has been pivoting lately is in community psychology and those type of like group dynamics. And yeah, it's interesting because yeah, I mean, a lot of my closest friends I've met on Twitter, talking about sports, talking about MMA, talking about wrestling, talking about hockey, whatever. But yeah, I wouldn't put them in a separate tier from like the folks that I've met, you know, in grade school.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've met like a lot of great people I now collaborate with because of Twitter or Instagram.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, do we want to focus on the good opportunities about it or the bad, you know? Yeah. And of course we can, do we need to address the bad stuff? Sure. But like I said, like we've needed to do that before Zoom.
I think it's all like a lesson of being conscientious. Yes. Practicing like mindfulness, what I don't, the majority of people don't do. And I think it's like an active practice. Like you really have to be aware. It's not just about opening a door for someone, being mindful. It's like other things.
You got to hit the switch. It's active.
And it really like enlightens you when you start really taking it seriously. But the problem is most people don't really want to analyze it that deeply.
It's hard.
Or like, But before we get into any further, let's take our first commercial break and we'll be right back.
All right, we are back with Dr. Tanisha. I like to say that, Dr. T. So let's go back a little. So like where, you said you were from Riverside. Is that where you were born and raised?
It is. The old IE, Inland Empire.
Inland Empire.
I left as soon as I could.
I mean, yeah.
Family's still there, but yeah. I guess not too bad. I came out all right, but I had an awesome foundation and great family to support me and stuff. It's changing a lot now, as is everything in Southern California and the IE specifically, like an hour out of LA. But yeah, it's where I'm born and raised. It's like the Reggie Miller and his sister Cheryl, Sammy Knight, Kawhi Leonard, and me. Oh.
Yeah.
My brother.
Yeah.
The notables come out of Riverside. I'm sure I'm missing some. I'm just joking.
where did you go when you say you got out as quick as you could?
I went to undergrad, UC Santa Cruz.
Okay.
And I wanted to play basketball. I was a jock kid. I played everything they let me. Loved sports immediately. And I was born in 83, right? So I'm 38. And in the late 80s, early 90s, when Mike Tyson was going in nuts, like my parents were kind of like the party fight house. So all their friends would come over and watch the fight. Mm-hmm. And when I was like 5, 6, 7, I just loved that everybody was having a good time and focused on like one central thing, like the television. And I was like, oh my God, this is so cool. Oh my God. And then I look at it, it's boxing. And so I remember I grabbed my brother's tube socks and put them on my hands and I threw a pillow over like the closet rod, started punching it because I saw them do it. And then they were like, yeah, go Toonie. I'm like, yeah, I'm gonna fuck up this bro. Because I saw that's what Mike Tyson was doing. So I've loved sports kind of since then. And my parents, you know, they grew up like Laker fans. I'm not. I'm a Clipper fan. But, you know, when you're 5, you don't have a choice. So sitting around on my dad's lap, eating popcorn, watching Lakers, like that's, sports was a big, my parents still are just huge sports people. We're always like, what time's the game on? Like, that's just who we are. And so I played everything they let me. I was kind of, they said I came out swinging. So I played, you know, volleyball, basketball a lot. And then the WNBA started when I was about a freshman or sophomore in high school. So it wasn't even a thing to even fathom being able to play professionally until I was about a sophomore. And I was like, hold up. You mean I could do this shit for Frankie Perry? I was like, oh my God. So I started paying much more attention to it. Yeah. But I was also a band nerd and I played alto saxophone and was first chair in everything. And I had this crossroads where my band director wanted me to switch to tenor for some reason. I was like, nah. And he was like, oh, and it's sports or music, pick one. And gave me this like crazy ultimatum.
What?
And I was like, yo, why? Like, I'm a 4-0. I've never missed anything. I'm fine. And I was like, and let me and your senior first chair have like a battle. And if I lose, then I lose, right? And he can be first chair because, you know, he had some senior and I was just a, you know, puny underclassman. I was like, let's battle. And if I win, then I get first chair and I get to stay alto. And he wasn't having it. And he was like, no, sports and music. So I said deuces and did sports.
That's a shitty teacher.
I'm saying that I'm 38. That was over 20. That was like over 20. I'm still upset. I'm still petty because I've never touched it since.
Wow.
And I was really fucking good. Mm-hmm. And that just made me realize, even in hindsight, how important the influences are around us when we're going through like youth development and in middle school and high school. That son of a bitch made me put down a saxophone that my dad bought me brand spanking new. I don't know how many, like probably a couple thousand dollars or whatever. And now sitting in their garage collecting dust.
Wow.
And I was good. And I don't flex a lot, but I was good. And yeah. So I did sports, got a couple looks and scouts. And so I got some scholarships to play Division II schools, like out of state. But my dad didn't want to let me go. He was like, no, it's too far. It's too far. Except he would have let me gone to an HBCU. That was the catch. Mm-hmm. He was like, you can go to Spelman. I was like, but that's out of state. He's like, but it's Spelman. And I was like, well, what's the difference? Like, why can't I go out of state to play ball? He was like, it's not an HBCU. And I was like, So I went to Santa Cruz because it was the farthest from home in the state of California.
Oh my God. That's so, the same reason I chose UC Davis.
See?
And I never even saw it. I was only allowed to apply to schools in California. And that was the furthest one I got into.
See? It's real. And I had a great time in Santa Cruz. I don't want to shit on it. And my roommate in Santa Cruz, we went to high school together. We played basketball together. And she knew everything about it. I didn't see it. She was like, you're going to Santa Cruz? Awesome. We're going to live in Oaks College in this dorm. And we're going to do here and go here. And I was like, all right. So I let a fellow teenager help just play it. I was like, here's my application, Claudia. Just do it. Shout out Dollface, Claudia. I love you. But she was all about Santa Cruz. So I went because she was there and it was the farthest from home. And I had a great time too.
That's awesome. I also wasn't allowed to go out of state, so.
Yeah. Well, not even apply.
It's the contingents, though. Like, I could have gone out of state if it was an HBCU, because that was obviously very important to my parents, which I now understand some 20 years out now, right?
Mm-hmm. But at the time, you're just like, you feel so intensely about your future, and like, rightly so. But yeah, you don't really think about the overall meaning of what it is.
Yeah. I guess that's just part of too, like just being older and recognizing those things. And because growing up in Riverside, we were pretty much like the Cosbys, right? Like the only black family, the other black girls, most of the only interaction I had with other girls of color was on the basketball team. Mm-hmm. That's where like all the other brown and black girls played. And most of them I wasn't friends with. And I remember my dad constantly asking, like when we would go have our like trophy like ceremonies and stuff at like Sizzler, that he was like, why don't they talk to you? Why aren't you sitting next to them and stuff? Blah, blah, blah. And I was like, I don't know. I don't fuck with them. We're just not friends. And he was like, what? And he would constantly ask too about my complexion. And that was something that as a kid and a teenager, I always wondered why. And I was like, that's crazy. My parents are very dark skinned. And me, I'm like, you know, reduced fat peanut butter. I'm like salted caramel, right? Yeah. But, like butterscotchy, pumpkin spice latte-ish. Delicious. Right. No colorism here. But when they saw my family and then they saw me, they're like, And the rooted colorism that happens in my dad's generation, he constantly was asked, does anybody say anything about your skin? What about your complexion? Are you okay with it? Does anybody say anything? And I'm like, yes. Mm. Nobody says anything like that. At least to my face, you know? But it's one of those things that like at Riverside, we were always like the only. And it was, I know they didn't like me, or at least weren't friends with me, because we had a mortgage and not rent, right? Like we were, a lot of them made jokes like, oh, is daddy going to buy you NYU? Because that was like the dream undergrad I wanted to go. And they rejected me three times.
Same.
So it was like, is daddy going to buy you NYU? Like, oh, you got a nice house, blah, blah, blah. And by no means were we the Cosbys, but just in comparison of like, we had a 3-bedroom house. Many of the others, you know, lived in apartments. That mortgage versus rent, like already in a kid's mind, especially of color, when you see others doing well, it's you're more inclined to just, you know, be envious or jealous or hate. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that would stop kids from being friends, you know. But I had a lot of great friends. I was considered like the get-along gang. I had obviously the band nerds. I had the jocks. I had like the wrestlers. I did BSB versus NSYNC battles. Like I was all over the place, which today, I don't know, some would call code switching or something. But when you're a kid, I was just like, hey, I like a lot of shit. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're like, I just fit in with everybody.
I fit in with, like a lot of different people. I like different stuff. Why is that weird?
So where did your parents, are your parents also from Riverside or did they move there?
No, my mom's from Selma, Alabama.
Okay.
Very much rooted. You know, she was born in 45 and she came to California, I think, when she was a teenager. So she's like, I love horror movies and stuff. And I remember like, oh, mom, I was watching The Exorcist. But she had this like sour taste in her mouth because she said like she remembered wanting to see it, but it wasn't in the colored theater.
Wow.
So it's like she remembers, you know, the water fountains and, you know, not being able to go here, not this school bus. Like she remembers that shit. So when folks are like, oh, well, racism, that's so in the past. Like, well, your ancestors. I'm like, ancestors? You mean my mom, motherfucker? Like, this is not, we're not talking far, right?
Yeah.
And my dad, he's from San Diego and he's a Vietnam veteran. He enlisted. He wasn't drafted, but he went in because he thought that's what a black man was supposed to do and a man was supposed to do at that time. And he was medically discharged and has a Purple Heart. He was shot. He was a paratrooper. He was shot jumping out of a helicopter or an airplane.
My God.
His chest is all deformed and he's got a lot of other issues right now that have, you know, that have come from PTSD and just a lot of trauma. He was a baby. He was 18 years old, right? Mm. And then retired from the Department of Corrections in Chino. So I always thought if there was going to be a movie about my family, like, remember that movie Green Mile with Michael Clark Duncan?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
mm-hmm.
I would want, there's a Polaroid picture of my dad in overalls with no shirt, like Michael Clark Duncan was in that movie, and just a bald head. But my dad had a giant afro and he was buff. Like, he used to do a lot of amateur bodybuilding and stuff when I was a kid. And he has this, there's this Polaroid of him like that. Overalls, muscles, fro, clean, look like a microphone. And then just holding me as a baby with the biggest, brightest smile on his face because he's always wanted a girl. And he always wanted a girl. And my mom was like, nope. And then makeup baby, here I came in 83. And he was like, yeah. Biggest, strongest dude I know. Went through more shit than I'll ever understand. And I still don't get it. But they have a lot of cultural roots and things that we're, you know, that are coming to the table now and people are just now, yeah, let me make a resource guide about when they are the living proof of a lot of the trauma and social injustices that are happening here.
Wow. I mean, wasn't that long ago.
It's not just grandmas and stuff. Like, it's my parents, yo.
Yeah.
So when I explain
that. They purposely put photos in black and white to make people think it was a long time ago. That's the fucked up thing about the fucking world.
Yeah.
Is that everything is manipulated. Even a photo in a history book or a photo that anywhere, like every photo of Martin Luther King is basically black and white, Jr. is black and white, but he was alive when there was color photography and video. Like, what?
Yeah. Like, let's just not study critical race theory anymore in Texas. Let's just rewrite what we want to say. Let's just cut fat out on stuff. And then people want to wonder why, like, they're so fucking lost. Mm-hmm. It's like, you have no roots. You have no preference on, like, where this stuff is. And race, culture, theory, and all of this stuff, it's like, I remember over last summer with, you know, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, the resurgence, BLM, I got just so much more awakening and about shit that I wasn't really conscious of or aware of at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, especially in academia, because they're always like, oh, you're the sports person. I'm like, oh, fine, sure, you can brand me that. But people always wonder, like, why sports? Why do you study this stuff? Why do you like fans? Why are you such a big fan? Why do you like all this stuff? And then for some reason, it just fucking hit me last summer. I realized I like sports so much. And maybe this is general with fandom too, like why I'm so passionate about these things, is that sports and entertainment are the only places I can go to see someone who looks like me succeed and praised.
Wow.
We praise entertainers. We praise athletes. Black cultures, American culture, pop culture. And that's where we see black men and women celebrated and praised and applauded.
Yeah.
Wasn't in the White House, weren't talking about doctors, weren't talking about vets, weren't talking about politics, we weren't talking about anything else. But when we talk about, oh, black pioneering, you know, like people that look up to, like they're black, they look like me. And subconsciously, I think that was just such a part of it. And it was shocking to a lot of people because then even thinking about my own education and how, what did I study? Did I perpetuate any of this? Like, did I accidentally play a part in something? K through 22, I guess, from getting my PhD, I recognized I had 3 black teachers my entire life.
Holy shit.
Like, I had, well, 4, including my kindergarten teacher, Miss Mitchell. Can't leave out Miss Mitchell. She taught me how to, like, make a turkey out of a hand. Mm-hmm. So, Miss Mitchell, kindergarten. I had Miss Hill, who was my avid prep teacher in high school, college prep teacher. And then I had Dr. Trisha Rose, who I love. And then, obviously, the iconic, pioneering Dr. Angela Davis, both at UC Santa Cruz.
That's incredible. That's right.
She's emeritus at UC Santa Cruz. Right. And I was taking a Black women gender studies class, and like the registration thing just said like lecturer. So I didn't know who was going to be. I just
sat there. Wow, that is such a beautiful surprise.
And then she walked in, I was like, ah! Like,
yeah.
I knew her face, right? Like, yeah. I was like, yeah. Whoa! So that's it. I had those 4 Black women in my life, and not my grad school where I went to San Diego State for new media production and screenwriting. Not where I got my PhD at Fielding Graduate University. That was it. And that, where I'm like, okay, like, who's in charge of giving me information?
Yeah.
Giving me history. Now I know why my dad wanted me to go to an HBCU.
Mm-hmm.
Now I know why all of this stuff is so important. Now I get it. But it's hard, too, because I've had these other conversations with great people that I've met online and done interviews with on I Have Questions, my other podcast. I've recognized that there's just so much privilege in being able to study art,
yeah,
and media and film. There's just so much privilege involved in that. Mm-hmm. Because we have to, I think women of color and Black women, we have to give ourselves permission to be joyful. You even joked earlier about like, oh, you're supposed to take care of yourself? Like, we have to give ourselves permission to do those things and the privilege that's involved. And it's because I think, because my mom struggled so much in Alabama and then moving, you know, doing a lot of Black Panther stuff in San Francisco where she went afterwards as a teen, to my dad in Vietnam and then in the Department of Corrections and as a sergeant and all of the struggles that they went through, their mentality was like, baby, I just need you to survive. You can worry about being happy later.
Yeah. The way you said about allowing yourself, like that, my body had chills. Like, that's exactly what it is. You you need to give yourself permission, and oftentimes you don't. It's such a privilege to just like pursue anything without a thought do anything without a thought of needing to do something else. I don't know. That's the perfect way to put it. Thank you for saying that.
I remember in 3rd grade, I saw the assembly, you know, when they bring out all the instruments and people are playing like hot cross buns or something stupid. And I was like, I want that big gold one, like one of the sax. Little did I know in my 9-year-old brain that my dad loves jazz and has always wanted to play the alto saxophone. So I randomly said, I want the alto saxophone. He left the house, came back with a brand new one because his parents couldn't afford it. He never got to play. And then here I came, wanted to play the exact same instrument. And he was like, you're not going to be without like I did.
I love that.
That's such a privilege.
Yeah.
And I want to study film. I want to study radio. And a lot of other households can just be like, no, be a doctor, be a lawyer, be something where you know that is stable because who knows what's going to happen with this whole arts thing. Like, you need to worry
because
about
it. At the end of the day, you have to survive.
Right. Yeah. They instead applauded my personality. And we're like, all right, just work hard. There'll be a lot of people who try and fuck you over.
Yeah. So. I do want to say that I'm really glad you defined fandom in a different way than I have it in my head, because in my head, that word is like very, again, I like, like mostly I think it's just like this fervent, almost like too much obsession. But the way you described it, it's so much more than that. Like, I'm putting my own bias on that word. And I like that you said that, because now I can think of it differently, because everyone has probably a lot of those personal reasons why.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, there's a lot of like, and in studying psych and learning about like audience engagement and branding and all of this stuff. And it's like, there's such a like a possession self link that happens, right? Like, think about like if there was a fire, the things that you would grab and leave, like we there's links to our identity into the possessions that we have and that we hold. And just think about like symbols, right? And the amount of meaning that we hold in that and how communities are developed. I mean, there's so much. Obviously, there's levels like high and low when it comes to fandom and stuff. But it's just about being connected to something else and being with your people, not having to explain anything. No. And just feeling
being
comfortable.
Being seen. Yeah.
Feeling seen. That's all we want.
I'm so glad you defined it that way. Thank you. Now I won't be as scared. I mean, like, you know the fandom that I'm trying to describe,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
That's not the only type of fandom. So I'm glad.
It's those, the bad apples, right? It's like, mm-hmm. oh, I really wish I could go to this baseball game, but there's going to be bros. There's going to be wasted. They're going to be stupid, like everywhere, right? I see the stupids in the gym, you know, all the time. Like, there's good and bad of all of it. And I think just in all the spaces that I'm in or affiliated with or have to observe for whatever reason, like, let me just find my lane and my people and try and concentrate on that and be more conscious in that as than worrying about those that will spoil it and the toxicity, because that's never going to end. I thought maybe for some reason, like, okay, maybe by Thursday, all the bad stuff will be gone. Or maybe I'm 35 or whatever. It's like, no, there's always going to be bad everywhere in different yeah. shapes and forms, and they'll evolve like us. So I'm just going to try my best to la 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 and just ignore that and focus on what gives me joy instead of wanting to pull out my hair or a baseball bat.
That's really great. I want to talk a little bit more about that, but let's take another quick break and we'll be right back after this. And we are back with Dr. Tanisha. Okay, I want to talk a little. You were saying before the break, like, you're able to push out the noise, you know, of the more evil side of, you know, fandom. I want to talk a little about your shows and, like, how that has kind of affected what you've created. First of all, actually, what got you into podcasting to begin with?
I've always wanted to work in media in some way, shape, or form. I always kind of thought of myself as like a storyteller. Mm-hmm. I like communicating and talking and just, and I like telling jokes. I remember, I think the best gift I got for Christmas once was like a Taco Boy. Remember those things from Home Alone?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's like a cassette player.
Yeah.
And it like does different voices and stuff.
Yeah.
Like they got me that when I'm in elementary school, and I carried that sumbitch everywhere. And I would like do voices. I was like, okay, mom, this is how you sound. And I would just like make fun of her or something. And they're like, girl, like, my kid is whacked, whatever. But that was like the first time I was like, oh man, like I really like this talking thing. And then I decided, like, in looking at schools and what I wanted to do, I consciously was like, all right, I'm applying to schools that have a radio, television, film program, RTF. Like wherever has a campus radio station, that's, I'm going to go there for sure. Santa Cruz passed that. They have KZSC, one of their campus radio stations. And I had a bunch of different shows there and was their diversity outreach coordinator. And shout out KZSC. Love them. I think because I originally, like when I was a teenager and stuff, like I knew I was going to be in media in some way. And I think my first dream job, I told a bunch of people, I was like, you know, I'm going to be the female Howard Stern. Okay. I'm going to put a white guy in a cage like he had Robin. I'm going to talk shit about dudes, make them walk around in underwear. And that's going to be my life. That's what I'm going to do. and it hasn't happened yet. But podcast, here we are. Maybe I don't have that white guy in a box, but...
Not yet.
Not yet. I really have no excuses anymore because we've talked about, like, everybody can do almost anything now. Just Google it. But so after I did that radio thing and I went to San Diego State, I did screenwriting. And then I kind of pivoted away from broadcast and got more into just screenwriting. I wrote a couple... independent feature films, mostly collecting dust behind me, wrote treatments for television, just loved storytelling and wanted to write a bunch of scripts. And I thought I was going to be this John Singleton media mogul kind of person and moved to LA. And I was like, oh God, this place is toxic. Oh God. Like, didn't like it as much anymore and worked in post, worked in everything. But then I saw social media was kind of becoming a thing. And I started doing social media for like the Viper Room and the Key Club and Hollywood Sunset. And, but I still always kind of loved sports and stuff. But then when I got my PhD, after I got there, I was like, you know, I still got this itch. Like I got a lot of stuff. And I took improv classes. I did stand up for a couple of years before I moved here to Vegas. And I think all of that are just reps and different skill sets on how to be a storyteller. And how to be a presenter. The things that I've been able to do now basically as a creative strategist and working for a lot of different companies and brands, giving them cultural insight, giving them creative strategy, developing content for them, traditionally and on social and digital, being able to travel and give talks about DEI, about fandom, about branding and marketing and psych. The improv is so important. The being able to talk is so important. And I didn't know these things that I did just because I thought it was fun and doing radio and talking about music and talking about sports and trending topics. I didn't know all of those things were just grooming me to be a better professional. And then the podcast, I Have Questions, I started that last fall and I just moved to Las Vegas. Everyone was crazy because COVID, we didn't know shit from fuck. And I was like, if I'm going to do a damn thing, like what? I'm just going to, I was just like, I should do it. I should just do it. And I should just get out of my own way. I should just do it. I should just hit record and do it. And my brother was like, what's your address? He lives in Denver. And then he bought me the Blue Yeti mic. He just sent it to me. And he was like, quit fucking around. Well. And I was like, oh, okay. So then I don't have any more excuses. Yeah. So then I started I Have Questions. Which is, you know, it's where culture and conversation collide. And I just interview dope people and we talk about what keeps us safe, sane, and entertained. And we talk about community related to their niche and their specific subject. So it's been from combat sports to erotic romance, black erotic writing to Taekwondo in DC to sociology in central New York. It's gone from everywhere. And I'm really happy about it. I like it. It's something I look forward to and I get mad at myself when I don't put enough energy into it. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm letting myself down because I think that's something that culturally, I think even just speaking independently as like a black female, I think imposter syndrome is not where, it's not coming from like, oh, I'm not capable of this. For me, it's like, am I getting in my own way? Well, I don't want to let myself down. I don't want to let my family down. I don't want to let everyone who is around me and celebrates me and praises me down. It's right. more rooted in that than ability and agency.
Well, again, you're very wise. I'm going to replay that. Thank you.
I don't know. I just feel like so much of where I come from now, it's just like, I just peep shit. I just see things. And I realized too, it's like sometimes I just have to stop talking. And that was, I learned in grad school when I was studying screenwriting, because it's like writers don't write, they listen. Mm-hmm. They observe first.
Yes,
you just
exactly.
translate it, right?
Yeah.
You watch first, you listen first, then you translate it. Having done that for so long and just trying to understand, you know, what the fuck's going on, I don't know how to say it any other way than to keep it real sometimes, you know? And people are like, oh, you're a doctor? Like, you're a you're a professor? It's like, yeah, I'm adjunct faculty. I'm a professor, you know? And they're like, oh, but you cuss. I was like, yeah. Yeah, I do. Like, but you like sports? You still, oh my God, I didn't know a doctor could do it. I was like, why? And that's my beef with academia sometimes is because I remember applying so much. It's gotten so freaking corporate. I mean, I love students and I love their curiosity and all that stuff, but it's like they're screwed right now. I think so many kids wanting to get into higher education are hashtag screwed. And I remember being interviewed at a couple universities that I applied to that had, you know, I thought dope programs that I could add some value. And they were like, oh, well, you have this podcast and you like sports and all of this stuff. And, you know, but you don't have a lot of publications yet and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, because I want to get like practical real world experience first, you know?
Yeah.
And they're like, yes, well, you're so colorful and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, yeah, well,
that is
just
so.
That's like, what I'm saying.
Condescending.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. And I remember I said this, and this is why I didn't get the job. Because I said, well, just because you get a PhD doesn't mean your spirit has to get surgically removed. And then they were like, oh. And it was on the phone, like on Zoom. And I was like, yeah, I'm not getting this. So then I just started relaxing, like leaning back and being like, yeah, and then the other thing.
Yeah.
But that's the thing. I think we see that so much. And as women of color, too, in the professional world, like there's so many more institutional narratives that are placed on us and expectations. That it's like, yo, I don't know what I'm doing tomorrow, let alone, you know, the rest of the night. So don't put me in your story because I don't know what I'm going to do yet. So don't think like, you know, tomorrow I may wear a Slipknot shirt, you know? So like, don't think I don't listen to metal. So it's like, we can't expect and predict and all of this stuff. But that's, you know, that, like we said earlier, it requires critical thinking. That's too damn hard for a lot of people.
Yeah. I see that a lot. Like, they can't reconcile very simple concepts sometimes. I feel like I progressed further in my career because I was able to like have fun in meetings. Like, I could joke around. Mm-hmm. I felt good, like, you know, really like teasing my higher ups. And I feel like they felt more comfortable with me because I was like, I'm not going to do this super, super professional thing. Like, we work in podcasting. I'm not going to act like I'm in a corporate office. Like,
you know,
I will be who I am. I mean, obviously I'm like appropriate. I'm not saying wild shit,
right. But like, we're not being.
So, you know, but like, I'm not going to change who I am. Like, I am who I am. There's a reason I'm here as a creative. I now have to work in more like meeting based situations because I've moved higher up in the company, but like, I'm still going to be me, and that's why I'm here. And that's, you know, it doesn't make me any less smart or able to contribute.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it also makes the image of success more like attainable and like,
yes,
just like doable. It's not this big divide of classism or like just expensive suits or something. It's exactly. Like, oh, that person looks just like me.
Yep.
Like, either like because they're also marginalized or because they're not dressed like they just came out of a fucking whatever. I was gonna say Nordstrom's, but that makes me sound so poor. If that's the most expensive store,
like, but
that's true, I guess. You can't grow out of what you grew out of, what you were like, but or are like. I don't know what that means. Anyway, moving on.
Nordstrom's expensive, I think.
But yeah, I think it makes it more attainable and less of this like yeah, you don't have to suck the air out of your fucking soul or whatever.
Yeah.
Like, it's you can be human and like everything that you like, and the fact that the publications, back to that interview,
yeah,
was what they wanted versus all the other things that you've done. It's like they dismissed everything because of what they think success is or what they think
exactly
the job requires.
Exactly. And it's all CV-based and where are you published? It's like academia's blue check mark on Twitter to see mm-hmm. that, okay, you've been in this journal, this one, you're verified. People care. And then just like how corporate this is all getting and stuff. I remember I wrote a manuscript about Black female fan identity and I was putting it out, getting feelers to, actually, I was like, oh, maybe I'll try and get another publication, right? And so put it out there, got accepted. And then they were like, okay, processing fee, $1,850. I was like, excuse me? They're like, yeah, by November 1st and your manuscript, thanks. And I was like, but what is that for? They're like, yeah, that's the publishing fee. I was like, So why do I have to pay you for my words? Just you, or, and it's not even like they're binding it. It's a digital freaking journal. I was like,
yeah.
They're like, yeah, well, maybe your university or institution will pay for it, which of course I just laugh because they already barely pay me gas money. So I was like, no, it's not. Nah, brah. And because then I thought about it even more. It's like my words, my thought that goes into writing this, the people I want to read it don't read that shit, no way. So I could get much better attention and eyes and have real conversations about it by putting it on my own blog and putting it on my own podcast and rapping with y'all about it. Those are the people that I want to read and listen and hear my voice and my thoughts. Because other highbrow, super scholarly folk that are in that institutional mindset, right? The ones that still don't want to pay athletes, that shit, where it's like, yes, it's that circle jerk, that corporatization of it. And it's like, and you want to charge $2,000 for like my own intellectual property at that point, mm-hmm. which is pretty much still what it is. It's my words. It's my research. But I was like, nah, you can take that. And I don't want to, I have a lot of great friends who are like tenured and stuff. And it's like, do I want that one day? Sure. But I want to make sure it's after I have enough real world application experience. Because every week I get a question from a student, new or prospective or past. It's like, what kind of job can you get with this? How do I get a job? And that's if you were major in literature, music, bio, or psych, or media psych. So it's like, they want to know what to do with this. And you know that's that line that people say. It's like, oh, those who do, those who don't teach.
Right.
It's I see why now. Because they want to only keep it in a space where those can afford $2,000 to put something out and then just keep doing that so much that, oh, now you're verified within this, like, you know, community that drinks punch out of this weird bowl, and then you get to go have an office and a parking spot with your name on it. I was like, I'm good. And I love teaching. I love my students. But the day I got to start to change or whatever, it doesn't, like you said, Anna, it's not, doesn't make you less smart. I still have such quality engagements every week when I talk to my students. And we have real conversations and we talk about real stuff and applying psychology to media. And that's, and it's real. And I get to do it in a sarong or a Slipknot shirt or with my nose pierced or my lip pierced or anything else, with tattoos showing or not, because it's the intellect. It's how you translate and reach people, not how many, you know, journals you're in or any of that. But that's a battle that is going to exist far, you know, beyond my lifetime in this experience. You know, it's going to be going on forever. So I'm not even going to try to battle that. Yeah. I'm just going to go where I know I can make, where I can contribute and who does value me. So I'm not trying to fight a war that I know I can't win. I'm just going to make, I'm too tired. I'm going to try and have fun.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of like what it is. I mean, in this, it's the modern being at this point. And if we can't like accept that, then there's no progress. We can't move forward. And we need to move forward.
There's some, I remember someone was like, they, you know, I was like, oh, it's great to think like, oh yeah, well, you know, I'm going to end racism. I was like, oh, by what? Next Thursday? Let me put it on my calendar, like send an invite so I can be there. It's like, it's really romantic to think I'm going to end world hunger. I'm going to end racism and all of this stuff. God bless you for thinking that. Maybe I'm just too sullen at this point because I've seen so much and I've seen what works and what doesn't. And a select few get lucky. But it's such a high romanticized thing. I'm more all about controlling what you can control. And if I recognize what my gift is, I would much rather use that to make some space, elbow room, box people out and make a space where dope shit can happen again and people can smile and have fun in spite of all the other things that we know are sad and troubling.
Yeah.
Then that's what I'm going to try and concentrate on, because I don't, it's, I'm too selfish and petty. It's like, I, yeah, it would be great if kids could have a future set up for them. But I was like, what about me? You know, like I'm not, what about me? Dude, just so fuck me, right? And you and you. And it's like, no, like, let's try to make something dope now.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll get lucky and we can find something that's sustainable out of that. Because the rest is just so damn hard. And I can't wake up every day and be like, oh God, I got to tackle this racism thing again. Like, that's just really, it's like, let's make some, you know, let's make a charcuterie board, man. Like, let's watch a movie. Let's make, let's do something.
Yeah. Fun. And I think that's all you can do.
It's all, I'm going to try and control what I can control. That's all I can do. And it's like the people that want to dedicate their lives and into real hardcore shit like that, God bless you. And I want to support. But I can't do it every day. It's too sad. It's too hard.
Yeah.
My parents sacrificed too much for me to be happy. And I'm not, I don't want to let them down again. That's like always my biggest thing. Like, I don't want to let my family down. Yeah. Because it's too much.
Yeah. It's like emotional fatigue. I feel like we've experienced that, me and Anna, on this podcast too. We used to be a news show mostly. Like, we would talk about Middle Eastern news and how it's underrepresented. And I still feel that it is that way, obviously. Mm-hmm. But talking about sadness and genocide and your home country being obliterated, like, that fucks you up if you do it all the time. Even my parents, I've been, like, everything going on in Palestine the past couple of years, I've been very vocal about that and about Syria and everything. And every so often, my parents are like, just to calm down. It's okay to just like take a breath. My parents, who are like Syrian and also care about their country, but I'm more fervent than they are. And they realize that it's eating away at me.
Yeah.
My mom purposely doesn't send me like photos of things or articles that have any type of thing that she knows will trigger me, because I will like, but
That's part of, you know, I think that whole self-care thing. And it's like taking in what we can as we can. And when we know it's no longer serving the purpose we wanted it to, back away.
Yeah.
And we can go back to it. We can revisit it. And yeah, was I out at protests and stuff? And I was like, hell yeah. But it's like, when I get home, I used to always work in coffee shops. Like, that's where I would wake up, go to the gym. I'd have my backpack, that shower there, get ready there. Then I would go straight to a coffee shop and work on my computer all day. I'd have like bro protein shake and like a little packed lunch and something. And then I wouldn't come home again until like dinner time because I didn't want to work at home. I didn't want to bring it at home. Even when I had like small apartments and stuff, like I never put my computer in my bedroom. So I was like, when I lay down, I like sleep. I like my pillows. I like my blanket. I like my space and spend a lot on it. I like my space. I don't want to bring anything there that will, like, I'm screwed up enough internally with my own shit. Like, I don't need, you know what I'm saying? Like, I don't need to bring extra into my space. It's like I deliberately tried to do that. And then the COVID fucked it all because then I couldn't go to coffee shops anymore. And I was like, no. So then I was like, fuck, I got to work at home. So I was like, guess I got to make some more money so I can make a second bedroom and turn it into an office.
Yeah. At the end of the day, I've realized it's capitalism. It's always goes down to capitalism and how we are just at its mercy at this point. Like, yeah, like I would like a separate office too. Mm-hmm. But that means I need to make a lot more money to afford something like that. And then you're kind of always in this cycle.
Yep. And that's why I was like, I have to leave LA. I had to. I bartended in Studio City forever. And then I went to Valley Village, then to Reseda. That was the last place. And then I went back home with my parents for a year, like right when COVID happened. And then I was like, I got to get out of here because I'm either going to off my folks and like everybody on this block. Like, I have got to go. And so I had some friends that had already moved to Vegas and it was so much cheaper and still close enough to home for if something goes down, I can get there. So I'm out. Because then when I started looking at places out here, I was like, yo, are you serious? Because I was paying like $1,500 for a one bedroom in Reseda.
Yeah. You're talking my language now.
Yeah, like, I didn't have anything. Yeah.
I'm the studio life, and that's LA. An LA studio might as well be a two bedroom in Arizona or something. Yeah. Like, I don't understand the price wise, not space wise.
Yeah, because it's like prison. I did 10 years in LA, 15. It wasn't worth it for me anymore. I didn't have to be there anymore, you know? And especially like I had gone through such a traumatic experience that I'm like still going through with like my last job out there. I could talk about it because it's public now. It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I mean, please, if you want to.
Yeah, the Hollywood Reporter talked about it, and I was on MSNBC talking about it. But I worked at America's Funniest Home Video, and I'm in the middle of a lawsuit with them right now because for retaliation, they laid me off after one of my bosses in front of like potential agents and everyone that I worked with called me a crack whore and told me I wasn't ever going to produce anything. Then after I told my boss, like, yo, that was fucked up, then they fired me.
What the fuck?
Claimed that it was, oh yeah, your position's no longer necessary when they just handed all over everything I was doing to somebody else because it was still very necessary. And that was like there was so much other stuff where it's like, oh, you haven't seen Black Panther? I'm blacker than you, blah, blah, blah. Just a lot. Oh, your hair, it changed. What the fuck? Like, just a lot of toxicity.
The micros and the macros.
Yeah, it snowballed into all of that. That happened in like 2018. Still in the middle of the lawsuit. Yeah.
That was in 2018. That was recent. Yeah. I mean, not that it matters, but like,
I was the first. And then after that, a lot of other horrible stuff happened to other people where one of my other colleagues caught our boss. She was wearing a VR headset and she says that she caught him taking a picture of her skirt. And then she filed a police report. She was fired. It's on the Hollywood Reporter. It's out. Our names are out. It doesn't matter at this point, but we've been in the middle of lawsuits and stuff back and forth with them. Because this all, for me, it happened, in 2018. Wow. Lord up and meet, like, went straight to the office and was like, wrong one.
Good. Yeah.
And was on MSNBC talking about it. Time's Up has been awesome and have been helping PR for our case, the National Women's Law Center and stuff, because this has happened all the time and it wasn't new, right? In LA, entertainment, that stuff is toxic. That stuff grows everywhere.
Yeah.
And I wasn't having it anymore. But I went through a huge, huge bout of depression after that. Because then, no matter what, like, and at that point, I still had my PhD, but even without it, it's like you're still always just going to be looked at as a crack whore, regardless of your credentials, regardless of your contributions that have been valued, like after promotions and after praise from others. Some people just don't like seeing Black women succeed, and you've got to put them down any type of way. Seen it, experienced it firsthand multiple times. And yeah, and so that's still ongoing right now, 3 years in. And, you know, COVID obviously stops a lot of stuff, but those things, so toxic, so all over the place. And then I was like, yeah, I really don't need to be in LA anymore. I don't really need to be. I'm not a beach person, never lived by the beach, couldn't afford to live by the beach. I'm out. You guys can't rent the sun. I'm leaving, which is what LA feels like sometimes. But so much of that I had to uproot and change because of what happened to me there and leaving, right? Like, yeah, not having that money anymore, right? Not being able to host family dinners, having friends. I had to move out of state, you know, and that was real because of like, have to go somewhere that's more affordable now, leave my family, leave all of that stuff, feeling still like even more like an imposter, the amount of depression and anxiety and stuff that like just comes from, well, no matter what you do, you're still going to be a crack whore. Mm-hmm. No matter what. That monster, like I said, I already had enough, right, internally. Yeah. And then, all right, now corporate, you know, or even just the business world, the professional world, they still feel the same. So it's like, I've got to be able to do what I can to make space for myself and work as a professional and be much more conscious with who I work with. And I'm interviewing them, not the other way around, because this is my career. Mm-hmm. Now. Yeah. You know, my career is in this space in creative strategy and research and media. This is a career. That was just a job. But I thought, you know, at the time that this was going to be an elevation period. And in hindsight, a great, horrible thing that happened to me because it woke me up.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. And that's like the hardest part is putting yourself out there to even wake yourself up. Like, you have to take a very hard step to get to where you are. I can't imagine.
Yeah. Sometimes to hit that counter, you have to get a hit first, you know, to throw a counter punch. You got to take your licks too. And it's harder for, you know, us women of color in this space, regardless, you know. I'm sure there's other industries too that similar shared experiences have occurred.
Of course. You're so right, though. I mean, it's unfortunate to really drill that into my head. Like, you're going to have to get hurt first, which is true. You're going to, like, in order to even,
to heal, you got to hurt.
Yeah, exactly. And that sucks.
Sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a delaying process. But it, you know, all of the, it makes us stronger when we come out on the other end and stuff. Very, very true. But I think it's just such a thing for women of color and us that where it's like, it's normal growing pains that white women just don't have to deal with.
Yeah. That's
they
such
would
a
never have to
luxury.
Say,
that's,
luxury, yeah. Right? They would never have to wonder how many white teachers they're going to get. They're never going to have to wonder about being stereotyped into, like, and I've changed my name and resumes sometimes before, like when I was still playing the game, right? Of mm-hmm. like getting jobs and just trying to make ends meet in LA. I was like, oh, let me take my education off. I got a lot more calls, if you can believe it. I've got a bunch of calls too where they're like, oh, we think you're overqualified. You know, and I was like, why? Oh, well, you have this PhD and it's like intimidating. And I was like, to who? Why? Because you think I'm just going to like walk around and correct your grammar? What the fuck? It's like, no, it's stupid. And that's why I was like, yeah, I don't need to work with y'all then. Like immediately, I would just know then. Because it's like, you're not, you bought that bull. You're playing that stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. That's what people are doing trainings for now. And it's cute where it's like, yeah, can you just do this presentation about this and talk about that? And it's like, okay, but you're going to pay me first. You're not going to make me like open up all these wounds and talk about diversity and DEI training and stuff and then be like, oh, can I have your slides? It's like, no, were you not taking notes? You can pay for it. If I did this curated research and stuff, if I'm doing these things, it's like, pay us what we're worth. Give us stuff, you know? It's like, we've earned it.
Yeah,
it's like, stop making it, thinking that it's going to be easy and handed to you. But that's part of the system of like making them feel like, yeah, you were entitled to absolutely everything.
You are just a endless supply
no,
of
this
wisdom.
Is great.
No, I can listen to you talk all day. Genuinely,
aww,
I just
thank you.
The way you word things is as it's as if I have the pieces in my head, and suddenly you arrange them for me to understand.
Hey, like I yeah. used to, what is it, like a Tool song or something where all the pieces fit?
Oh yeah,
it's a Tool song.
We need to take one more break. When we come back, we can talk about where people can find you and all the good stuff you're working on now. So don't go anywhere. And we're back. Wow. I really need to like, I can't wait to listen back to this when it comes out and truly like write down everything you said.
Thanks. I mean, I think it's like you said, like you had the pieces, and it's not like to say like I, you know, am this word guru or not. I'm not. It's just trying to express what I've seen mm-hmm. and try to make, you know, some sense out of things. And maybe it doesn't make sense now. Maybe it even will later. I think we've all, sometimes it just takes someone to assemble all of these different pieces that we know are out there, but just need context and just how to sew all of this stuff kind of together. And I think that's, I kind of pride myself in that. It makes me feel really, really good to hear you say that. So I thank you. I appreciate it.
I mean it. I mean it so much. My brain is, it's not good up there right now. So thank you.
Mind blown. Mm-hmm. It's hard because sometimes it makes me feel weird. And I was talking to a friend and, you know, expressing that I was kind of depressed. And then he was like, but aren't you like this thought leader guru genius that everybody loves and looks up to? And I was like, yeah, no, yeah, but
yeah,
maybe, I don't know, but it's all a part of that, like, I don't want to let people down thing. And it's weird because sometimes I'm just like, why do people like me or listen to me? And so it's weird because it's people are like, you're the most accomplished person in the world. And I'm like, no, I'm not. Sometimes I still have to see if I can get extra avocado. Like, sometimes I still gotta like, can I afford extra avocado this month? No? Okay. So there's still real shit.
Yeah.
You know, we're all out here. It's hard. Gas keeps still going up. I'm like, maybe no bacon this time.
Yeah.
But then it just goes back to like, all right, I have to do what I actually say. That's the hardest thing too, right? Doing what, taking your own advice about like, all right, well, what do I define as success?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a mortgage? Is it being able to get avocado without looking at your bank account first? What is it? And those are things that when I was 20, I would have a different answer than I was at 25, then at 30, and then 30, same now. So it's hard to keep track of all of it, right? Of ourselves and of our own growth.
Yeah.
But we have to because we're the only ones that can have our back at the end of the day, guaranteed.
Yeah. I mean, God, this is very... I'm glad I asked you to be on the show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I got to know you on this level. It's really nice. I feel like I have such a better sense of you and like a lot of things now. And this made me feel a lot better. I've been having a bit of a long week, if you know what I mean. Just long week. I mean, I want you to come back on our show again. I mean, this is so great.
I would love to. Thank you for the invitation.
I can't wait to have you on. I mean, it's going to happen sooner rather than later because like I just want to talk to you about every single thing.
I can tell you about the game tonight, or no. You're going to be like, what? No, it's fun. I like a lot of things. I like being a fan. I like feeling good. And so talking about my family can be both super deep and funny. My mom's an OG. Like, she's hilarious. She accidentally dyed her hair blue. I was like, how the fuck do you accidentally dye your hair blue? She looks like a Smurf right now.
Oh, my God.
And she was like, it was my birthday. What? I got high, and I didn't read the box. I thought it had nothing to do with me. It said turquoise, and I was like,
oh, my God. That's so hilarious.
Like, my mom's, like, my family's funny.
Yeah.
We can, and then they also can then say, like, the deepest shit ever, right?
Right,
and
right.
It's like, I do the same thing, and it's like, I can, you know, blow minds or maybe if you know in saying something and giving some insight and then I'll be like, you know, have you ever thought about why washer and dryers don't do it's not all in one? Like dishwashers aren't. Why isn't there an all in one washer and dryer? Like so I could get stupid, I could get, you know, nerdy in sports. I love wrestling, like I don't know any other 38-year-old black women PhDs like still talk about pro wrestling. Like, I just like to have a good time, you know? So I would love the invitation. I appreciate you both having me on and asking me these questions.
Yeah. It's been a privilege to hear you speak, to be honest.
Thank you.
And aww. I mean, this is kind of what you were saying. This is what we can do ourselves. We have this. I mean, when we got burnt out talking about news and kind of the darkness that goes on in the Middle East, we were like, well, we don't want to end the show. We just want to keep having a place where we can talk to people like you and you a platform and give you space to talk about your experiences. And that's all we can do, you know?
Exactly.
Indeed. That's all. I love it. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Where can our listeners find you on the internet? Where can they listen to your shows? Drop all of it.
Yes. So I'm mostly active on Twitter. It's at T Singleton Says. You can catch everything from brain gyms to live tweeting sports to sharing articles. And it's a little bit of everything on my Twitter account. Don't have Instagram. It's private. It's just pictures of my dog. Who you could also follow at Cleophas Uzaking, my golden retriever puppy. He is awesome.
A puppy.
My podcast is I Have Questions. I'm a part of the 19 Media Group. I joined that group this summer, which is awesome. You can find that everywhere words are listened to. Spotify, Apple, Spreaker, everywhere. Google Podcasts, all the things. You can follow along with some of the episodes like hashtag IHQPod. You can find that on Twitter as well under the same tag, at IHQPod. My website, TanishaSingleton.com. You can drop me a line there. I will get it. Or DMs are open. Hit me up on Twitter as well. That's probably the easiest way to get me that and or just dropping me a note on my website.
Wow. Thank you. Yeah. I love that you are so accessible, by the way, because everyone needs to hear and read everything you say.
Aw, thank you. I should hire you as like my hype man. You can just like follow me around and be like, listen to what you say.
I'm just a fucking sap. I think about things too, like emotionally, I think, all the time. So I'm just like, oh my God, this makes me feel so good. I have to say how it makes me feel good.
Aw.
I'm working on it.
We need that.
Yeah.
We need that. I need that. Like, I was shitty before I sat down here. So thank you for making me smile and your beautiful smile is looking at it and hearing your comments of how what I've said has touched you. It means a lot and it's totally shifted the day and I'm going to make sure it changes the rest of the week too for good so I don't put a hole in the wall.
Well, thank you. That makes me feel really nice.
Awesome. Good.
If this is Ethnically Ambiguous, it's Ethnically Amb, A-M-B on Twitter, and Ethnically Ambig, A-M-B-I-G on Instagram. I am Shireen, it's Shirohiro on Instagram, and Shirohiro666 on Twitter.
And I'm just at Anna Hosty on Twitter.
And until next time, listen and read everything.
Yeah, that Dr. Tanisha says and writes and does. Go listen. Ethnically Ambiguous is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.